If you are sitting at home next to your radio, you're hearing the music faster than you are if you're in the hall.
Listening for the secret. Searching for the sound. This is The Sound Podcast with Ira Haberman.
For doing well, should I feel bad 'cause I can't tell? I felt guilty there for a spell, but now I need to know. Am I wasting my time? Ooh. Is there some trick to being happy? I'm feeling like a half me, and feel that life is moving past me. I only told you 'cause you asked me. Privilege and his power, how it turns sweet love oh so sour. Still I need to know. Am I wasting my time? Ooh. Is there some trick to being happy? Most days I'm feeling like a half me.
Listen to Trick to Happy, the first track on the Bahamas' latest release, Sad Hunk, out today wherever you get music. I've been watching the Bahamas' career grow since his debut in 2009 and that album, Pink Strat. For those that don't know, Bahamas is actually the stage persona of Afi Yurvinen, one heck of a guitar player who toiled on the Toronto and Canadian indie music scene until being recognized by Jack Johnson's Brushfire Fairytale record label. They quickly signed him, and the rest, they say, is history. His music blends all kinds of styles and genres, but his sound is distinctly his. His humble and quiet manner is hardly rock star in any way, and so I was curious how he landed on the ironic Sad Hunk album title and the absolutely oddest album cover ever. And that's where our conversation started.
The title was maybe 10 years ago when I was doing the Bar Chords record. Now Magazine wanted to put me on the cover. And we thought, okay, great, thanks. And we did a photo shoot. And when they sent back the photos, every picture that they sent back was like in shadow and brooding. And we're looking at the test pressing of the photographs to pick the cover or whatever. And my wife just walked by and she said, oh, Sad Hunk. And she sort of, you know, like it was a joke, you know?
Yeah.
And Heather, who works with me, who still works with me, and she was there, and we all laughed about it, and it kind of just became this inside joke. And then other friends Like, it just became like a joking nickname when somebody wanted to make fun of me.
Yeah.
Because the music industry, as you know, is constantly trying to frame people in a certain way. And I would purposely try and send these photographs that are like a shit-eating grin. And, you know, they would always try and they'd say, we need something a little bit different. We want this, we want that. And there always seemed to be this sad hunk photograph that everybody wanted. So, you know, I think when it came down to it, like, I just sort of embraced it, you know, like at this point, I like the way it sounds, you know, I like the idea of like a something that's beautifully broken. And perhaps all of us can kind of relate to that in some ways, but it's also just kind of like the word hunk is so like, I don't know if it's just 2020 or whatever, but it's almost like borderline, like it makes people feel weird.
Totally.
Yeah. So I kind of like that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Cause I think anybody that knows me knows that there's obviously some it's part of that is in jest, you know, I'm, there's no part of me that's being like, I'm a hunk, you know, it's obviously something else. And, anybody who isn't willing to put in 10 seconds of thought into that to get beyond that is, you know, they can go do something else. But, you know, it just sounded cool when it comes down to it. I just liked the way it sounded. I thought, you know, this is fucking cool. Let's just bring this joke to the rest of the world.
The other thing is the album cover itself has this throwback, you know, the font is such a throwback to the 80s.
Yeah,
and there you are with your slides and your socks on, like the kids will dig that for sure.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing is like, that's kind of the photo I always wanted, you know, like 10 years ago, I was like, why did you bring a stylist with like a whole rack of clothing? Like, I kind of want to just wear my own clothes or whatever.
Right.
And so the album cover was kind of just part of that. It was like, I just want to get like a classic studio shot. Like, in fact, when I told Heather, who does all my artwork and stuff, I said, you know, what I want to do is like, I want the cover to be like I signed a giant record deal in 1991.
Yeah, perfect.
And it's like my first album, and I'm just so thrilled to be in the game, which is how I feel. You know, I just feel, you know, I do feel very honored to just be in the game. And so I found that Bonnie Raitt album cover. It's a Nick of Time, and she's just on the cover with that same sort of Sears like gray backdrop. Yeah. And she's just standing there smiling for the camera. And I thought, that's it. That's exactly what I want to do, you know? So I think we nailed it. I really liked the cover. It kind of came out good,
I laughed because it's so perfect. Yeah. It's so like, and the juxtaposition from Sad Hunk to that photo, like the whole thing is just.
It's by design for sure. I mean, it sort of softens the blow of the word hunk too, by having a photo like that, which is like, the opposite of what you would expect it to be or something, you know? So
it could be like a Borat, like the next Borat movie could totally be the same kind of thing, right? It's hilarious. Hilarious.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Your sound has always defined genre categories, but you sort of incorporate everything from pop and R&B to rock and folk and soul. Alternative, there's obviously a band named Bahamas has to have some Caribbean sound to it. Is that really important for you to sort of be this genre bending guy? I mean, in 2020, almost everybody's a genre bending guy, but you've been doing this for a while now. You've been blending melodies and sounds and stuff for, going back to Pink Strat, right? I mean, this is kind of your sound.
Well, I mean, I appreciate that. I hope that I have a sound that's as recognizable as let's say Willie Nelson or something. I love the idea of something happening, whether it's on the guitar or through my voice, and someone being able to hear that and identify it right away. I mean, that's pretty important to me. So I definitely think about that as I'm writing and as I'm making the albums. But I'm not sure that I think about it any more than that. Like in the early days when I was first starting out on the Pink Strat record, on the Bar Chords record, again, like working with labels and working with people, you know, they're always trying to put you into this category of what you do. And I literally have been told before that, it's a problem because we don't know what kind of music you make. You don't really make rock music and you don't really, you know, make alternative music. And in fact, I remember at the Junos when I was there for Pink Strat, like I was nominated for Traditional Roots Album of the Year. And I remember sitting there thinking to myself, this is the weirdest category. Like that's, I was flattered that they wanted to recognize the album and include me. But at the same time, like, well, yeah, you're right. I don't belong in the rock category or the R&B category. So it's like they just kind of put me to the closest thing that they could. And at some point, you know, that turned around completely for me. It used to be a sort of a curse and more of a drawback in terms of my professional career. And then now that I've been doing it for more than 10 years, it's actually become an advantage because people don't know what's going to happen next. And there's something exciting about that. And the fans who have kind of been following from the beginning, that's part of why they like it, is because it's sort of evolving and changing and you're kind of along for the ride, so to speak, you know?
It probably helps too that you're on Brushfire, right? And that Jack and the rest of the team at Brushfire are so open to different sounds. I mean, Jack himself has so many different sounds, but you think of ALO and you think of you and other people, mm-hmm. Zach Gill's solo work. All of you have kind of this, you're all your own unique artists, and that's okay when you're on a label like Brushfire, probably.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, we've been working with those guys for a long time. And the truth is, like, when I say working together, it's pretty hands-off, you know, like they do really believe in what I'm doing. They're very supportive and they're fans. Like they were fans before we worked together. They'd come to my shows when I play in LA and stuff. And, you know, so I'm proud of that relationship and we've done a lot of cool things together. And yeah, they really couldn't be more supportive, you know? And I say that in spite, like, I've never really had big success with radio. They really, you know, they really kind of got it that I have this joke, this sort of long running joke with my manager, Robbie, when we first started working together, I said, Robbie, listen, here's my plan. I want to get rich slow. and we laughed, but I was like, no, that's serious. Like, we're not going to chase the trends. We're not going to do whatever. It's like, I just want to make quality records, you know, as cliche as that sounds. I just want to make music that's good that I can listen to 20 or 30 years from now and not be completely pissed off and be like, why did I do that? Why did I do a cover of Old Town Road or something, you know, like yeah. when everybody else was doing it, like I'm going to do the opposite of that. So, you know, it's not in the name of just being weird for weird's sake. I mean, I still want to make music that's accessible and has the potential to reach a lot of people and have a big audience. But, you know, I think I'm very fortunate that I found those guys in LA to work with and they, in terms of creatively, like I really do whatever I want, you know, and they sort of helped me figure out the best way to get it out into the world and get it to as many people as possible.
Before we dive into Sad Hunk, you did win a Juno Award. And for those who aren't aware, because we have a large American audience, a Juno is the equivalent to a Grammy in Canada. You won Adult Alternative Album of the Year in 2019 at the Juno Awards. They finally have a category for you, which is great, yeah. For 2018's Earth Tones. And you received a Grammy nomination. How important is that to be recognized? Not by the fans, because I think you have a pretty loyal and strong fan base, but to be recognized by the industry for what you're mm-hmm. doing and the you know, the writers and everybody else who's part of the music industry to be recognized for your work now, what, 10, 11 years in?
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, like I said earlier, even when my first record, when I was there at the Junos, I brought my mother and it was like, we had a wonderful time and it is important to me, you know, I think about it when I'm writing songs or when I'm making records. But when we put them out and we go on tour, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work for me. It's a lot of work for the musicians that I work with and the crew and everybody's, you know, everyone's taking time out of their lives and people who have kids and families and whatever you got going on to take time away from that, to dedicate to what I'm doing. You know, I'm really grateful for that. And it is important to recognize that. And further to that, I think, like, you know, Canadians should be proud. They probably aren't even aware of how much music we export to the rest of the world. You know, to most people, it doesn't matter that I'm Canadian, right? It doesn't matter that Drake is Canadian. It doesn't matter that Neil Young is Canadian. It doesn't matter that Joni Mitchell or Leonard Cohen or you know, like the number of great artists that continue to come out of Canada, you can kind of set your watch by it. You know, it's pretty reliable. And I don't know what it is, if it's just the being the underdog, being so close to America and wanting to kind of like be able to hold your own in that commercial arena. But, you know, I'm proud to be a small part of that. And it is nice to be recognized in Canada and elsewhere for that work.
It's interesting that with your success, you haven't moved to LA, that you've stayed in Canada, that you've stayed here and this continues to be your home, because a lot of people, you know, Neil Young is a great example. He's moved away. Joni's moved away. Lots of Canadian musicians who have done really well in the States have moved away. You've decided to stay here. Is there a specific reason why Canada remains home?
Well, I don't know if it's one specific thing, but there are many reasons. I mean, when my wife and I decided to leave Toronto, we did look at Los Angeles, and I think professionally and creatively, I would love to be in Los Angeles. The pool of talent there in terms of the musicians and the producers, I've done a fair amount of recording there. I mean, my Earth Tones album was recorded there. And, you know, a lot of the industry is there now too, just because the tech business is on the West Coast. And so all the labels have kind of moved out there. And there's a lot of infrastructure out there for making cool stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So in that way, it was really attractive. But, you know, I think I do have a whole life that's outside of music. And, right. You know, I have a family and the things I like to do with my kids don't care about what I do at all. You know what I mean?
Right.
They care about fishing and swimming and you know, running around in the woods and stuff. So I'm in that fortunate position where I can live here and have that life for me and my family. And then I get to go away and travel and go to LA and make records. I kind of get to have my cake and eat it too in that regard, you know?
Right.
So it took, it took whatever, 10, 15 years to kind of get to that point. But yeah, it was a conscious decision to, instead of moving from Toronto to an even bigger city, we kind of went the opposite direction and moved to a much, much smaller place. Just to be at some remove from that, you know?
I get it. So let's talk a little bit about Sad Hunk. I mean, we talked a bit about it off the top, but let's dive into to the music itself. And first I want to ask you about one of the things two of the things that I think are synonymous with Bahamas Records are your vocal phrasing and hooks, mm-hmm. hooks aplenty. I mean, there could be, you know, in one song, there could be five or six different phrasings or hooks that are part of mm-hmm. the sonic landscape. When you're writing this stuff, are you conscious of that vocal phrasing? Like how many words you can get in before you have to shift to a new idea, or is it just write it all down and then when you go to sing it, that's when the vocal phrasing comes through?
I think it's a bit of both. I think there's certain songs, like, I mean, I'm not sure how familiar you are with this new album, but you know, certain songs like Half Your Love, which to me just is, you know, that was like a real, it's like a, dare I say, traditional tune, just in the way it's crafted, you know? And it's almost like the words just, you know, came for that one. They just came perfectly when they came, you know? And that's the best possible scenario. I co-wrote that one with this guy, Pat McLaughlin in Nashville. I had gone down there to write songs for other people. And, you know, but we had this session and we wrote this song together. And I thought, this is, you know, we did it in 2 hours. We're just sitting in a room drinking coffee, playing guitar. And I came up with this tune. And I thought, I wish they could all be that easy, you know?
Right.
Some of the other tunes just require a little bit. You kind of have to crack the code a little bit. You know, there's a lot of times where I'll have a verse and a chorus for like a year.
Right.
And I'm not even sure what the song's about yet. And then I realize what it's about and it allows me to kind of go back and I write the first verse, you know, and I realize that the verse that I've had for now is like for so long is the third verse or something. And what really the song is about, what happened before or something like that. And sometimes, so, you know, again, like as cliche as it sounds, like just being open to taking the song any way it's willing to come. I don't have one hard and fast way that I like to work. I more and more I write songs without even an instrument. I just, you know, if I'm driving somewhere, or if I'm just sitting here in my office, like sit on the couch and reading a New Yorker, and then I might have an idea and look out the window and try and come up with a song, you know?
Is it an ongoing process for you writing music, or
it's an ongoing process? It's an ongoing process. Yeah. I really kind of am a firm believer that discipline is much more important than motivation or inspiration. For me, you know, I think maybe other people wait around to get that lightning rod and then the big ideas come. Mm-hmm. But for me, it's definitely like, it's a lifestyle. It's like, it's a daily thing that I'm aware of. And the hardest thing is just making time for it, you know, cause you're just I'm living life. I'm making dinner. I'm going to pick up the kids from school. I'm doing whatever. And I might have this kernel of an idea. I'm like, that's kind of cool. But I need, you know, a big part of my process is daydreaming and essentially being bored. And so have to, you know, you can't have Netflix, you can't have podcasts, you have to create space in order to get bored, to get down to that root and discover what the essence of these songs is. And I guess that part of me just feels cheesy saying that, but it really is like these songs, I mean, you heard the lyrics, they're, yeah. You don't have to wonder what it is I'm singing about.
No.
And to distill the lyrics down to that point for me, it is a process, you know? Cause I never want to be too verbose and just for the sake of just throwing out flowery language. I just want to get to the point as fast as possible.
You know? It's true. You do have an excellent economy of words when you're writing. And I think that speaks to the idea of your vocal phrasing too. Trick to Happy is actually the song that opens the record. It's a laid back, soulful entry point. I think everybody right now in the last 6 months, and I don't know when you wrote this tune, is thinking about how to sort of be aware of what's going on and how to be happy in these effed up times, for lack of a better word, right? I mean, it's a pretty apt song for these times. And I don't know when you wrote it, but do you agree with that?
It's a couple of years old. I think that the times we're living in are in some ways, you know, they're a culmination of many things and a continuation of a path that we've been on for some time. I don't think these things come out of nowhere, you know?
Right.
So the biggest thing for me, and I think for all of us, especially living in Canada and living in America, is we have a surplus of options for everything, right? There's so many ways to be happy. There's so many things that you can be into. And the biggest challenge that we have now is deciding. We have to actually decide. Whereas before, a lot of people didn't have that choice. You didn't have a choice between an iPhone and a Samsung and a Google phone. Sometimes you just had a landline and that was your phone.
Yeah.
You know, and for better or for worse. And I think we've just come to expect that our life, we deserve all these incredible products and this amazing technology. And now we're realizing, wait a second, is this making me happy? Like, we have to navigate all this stuff, you know? Right. And it's sort of manifesting itself in social ways and political ways. And, you know, again, that's a sort of part of the reason why I sort of live where I do is just because it is somewhat removed from that struggle a little bit, you know. Right. You know, it exists here, but there's sort of a blue collar aspect to the people here in Nova Scotia, and a lot of talented people and smart people and a lot of great artists and a lot of great musicians. But there is a sort of an acceptance of like, yeah, well, we live out here, nobody cares about what we're doing anyway, so we're just going to get down to work and get it done,
right?
And at the risk of sounding sort of old-fashioned or something, that really appeals to me, and I can sort of connect to that part of it, you know.
Done Did Me No Good and Up With The Jones are signature Bahamas tunes. If you're a fan of Bahamas, you'll put on this record and you'll know right away. Well, you'll know right away that you're listening to a Bahamas record, but those two songs in particular, is there a Bahamas sound? Like you say, it does kind of move all over the place, but you know, the up-tempo and the harmonies, I mean, that is a quintessential Bahamas tune, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, a lot of that's just how I like to approach the recording, you know. And I mean, the biggest difference for this one for me is I didn't play very much guitar on this album at all. I had this guy, Sam Weber, fly in from the West Coast, and he's an incredible musician. And then Christine, who's played with me for several years, she played a lot of guitar on this record too. But again, that was, in a way, that was, I thought, oh, my guitar playing is the thing that's sort of holding the record back, because my, the more I focus on writing songs, the less time I spend practicing the guitar. I realize there's things that I want to do on the guitar that I don't necessarily have access to in the moment. And so I sort of look to play with these musicians that do have that facility and dexterity and can just respond to what I'm singing and what I'm saying in real time on the guitar. And I thought that by me not playing guitar, it would have this radical different sound. And of course, it just sort of, you know, for better or for worse, it sort of, it does kind of just sound like me at the end of the day. You know, I kind of like that you can't quite tell who's playing what. It sort of melds into one. And, you know, maybe it's sort of a, just the songs themselves sort of tell people how to play them.
Right.
And, you know, it's a nice feeling actually as a writer to sort of feel like there's so much there to grab onto for me to sing to and for the other musicians in the room. It feels like we're working with material that's worthy. You know, it's like you went to the grocery store and you brought home like organic beef and you brought home fresh market vegetables, and you're so excited because you know that it doesn't matter what you do. Even if you just put the steak in a pan with some salt and pepper, it's going to be amazing. It's like the ingredients are solid, you know, and I definitely felt that going into this record.
Is Michael Bryan still playing bass with you in the studio or on tour? Or
we did a tour last year in New Zealand and Japan, and we went to Korea. We went to all kinds of cool places together. I sort of have him and Don Kerr, who plays drums. They're sort of just like this hidden weapon that I sort of go to from time to time. They play together I think they play together with Dan Mangan and maybe some other things in Toronto. And we've done a lot of recording together over the years for other people's projects and for my own. But Mike is like, we went to high school together, you know. We had blues bands when we were like 15 years old, when we didn't even know what the blues was.
Right.
We like would play like BB King songs and stuff when we were learning how to play guitar. And so that's someone, you know, I'm sure like you have the same thing in your life. When you have old friends like that, who there's a level of trust there that's just so deep that, I mean, we spend most of our time just making fun of each other, like teasing each other, you know? And that's, to me, that's the best. Like, those are the people that I want to be surrounded by. I want to be surrounded by people that can make fun of me. And I know it's not malicious. It's like, you know, it's just part of the dialogue. And so
brotherly love or whatever,
brotherly love and sisterly love. And yeah. And so with him, you know, his guitar playing, he's an incredible guitar player, almost like a Brian May, like very dexterous and poetic and lyrical in his playing. And for me, I don't know that I would ever ask him to play guitar on my albums. And I, you know, I'm sure he'd just be like, screw you. but for playing bass, like, when he plays the bass like a guitar player, and he's so musical and melodic, almost like Paul McCartney or Ron Wood or something.
Right.
And so there's times definitely when I, like, you know, for this record, I just knew, I was like, I want to get Mike to play on this one, because it just felt like the songs had a lot of bounce to them, a lot of energy, and Mike's personality just sort of suits that really well.
I only bring Mike up specifically because there were times where I was listening to this record where I felt like I was listening to an old Zeus record. Like, I felt like some of the phrasing or some of the themes, and that's probably Mike's playing, right? I mean, that's probably
what
it is.
Well, it's Mike's playing. And again, like, we just grew up together. We've been playing in bands together in one form or another you know, since we were 15, 16 years old. And I played a lot of guitar on the Zeus records, the first couple anyway. And, you know, it was just in the early days, it was like we were just very involved in each other's thing, you know. And then we had a period where I was doing something else and he was busy with Zeus, and that Zeus had turned into a real band.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just so nice to just sort of pick up where we left off kind of thing, you know, because as a player, he's just that much better. And yeah, more than anything, it's just like that familiarity and sort of being super duper comfortable in the studio, you know. It's like playing with him is just like, it's like wearing sweatpants. It's like, right. It's just, you don't have to hold in your gut, you know, you can just kind of let it all out with him. And you know, I hope everyone's as lucky to have friends in their life like that.
Sad Hunk has 11 songs. I think fans will really love it when it comes out October 9th, I want to say.
Yes, sir.
It's a great record. Thanks so much for taking the time today. Continued success, dude. I was so psyched when I got the press release that you had a new record coming.
Awesome, man.
It is really great. And have fun out east, because that's God's country, man. So enjoy it. All right.
Oh yeah, the salmon season's coming up.
Oh, here
and
we
no
go.
Touring for me.
So you're touring with the fish now. There you go.
Yeah, that's the way to go. Well, I appreciate your support. Thanks so much, and nice chatting with you.
Great guy, great sound, and a great new album. For more on Bahamas, visit bahamasmusic.net. Before we leave you, let's have a listen to another track off of Sad Hunk. Here is Own Alone.
That they meant me, that just left me feeling empty. Things are changing now so quickly. I feel that history has picked me. I was a fool to think you'd miss me. Ain't it the truth, or is it just me? Raise a glass now for everyone, all God's children under the sun. Raise a glass now for only me. Cold and broken, lonely me. I'm on my own. I'm on my own. But I'm not alone. I'm on my own. I'm on my own. But I'm not alone. Too broke to feel so wealthy. To feel unhealthy, but I'm too old to understand that selfie. Too far gone for you to help me. Try and talk less and listen more. Try and open every single door. Try and move the people on the floor. Try and play the game, not keep the score. Raise a glass now for everyone, all God's children under the sun. Raise a glass now for only me, cold and broken, lonely me.
Been listening to The Sound Podcast. Technical production by Adam Karsh and Andrea Ruse. Inspired by the music we love. For more, visit thesoundpodcast.com.